Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Keval Ramani, and today I have with me Suyash Desai, who works with me on China. And we have a special guest, renowned author, journalist, strategic affairs analyst, who's done multiple books and who's got intimate knowledge of how China operates in Southeast Asia and also in the Indian Ocean region. And that's broadly going to be the conversation that we have here. Welcome, Bertil Lintner.
Thank you.
Welcome to Bangalore. And
thank
welcome
you very
to Takshashila. So I'm going to start first off going back to the past as opposed to looking at the present. You've done a book on the India-China war in 1962 in the past, and you had a different thesis from what Neville Maxwell had argued. Yeah. And the argument that you made was that, look, the Chinese were preparing for this conflict. It wasn't something that was precipitated by the forward policy by India, but it was rather something that the Chinese were preparing for from 1959, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
And that has to do with sort of many other things, along with the fact that Dalai Lama sort of escaped to India and sort of domestic turmoil within the Communist Party with regard to Mao's role. So could you first tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll go forward?
Well, when I first read Neville Maxwell's book, I was very impressed because it was very detailed and it seemed rather convincing. His arguments were rather convincing, I thought. But the more I looked at it, it didn't really make sense. But suddenly then, in 1962, you have tens of thousands of Chinese soldiers launching simultaneous attacks all the way from Kashmir to NEFA, the Northeast Frontier Agency in those days. Looking at the firepower they used, the number of troops they moved up there, and I realized that this is nothing that could be done within a couple of months or not even a year. Because you're talking about very high altitude warfare here, where the air is very thin, where people have to be acclimatized and wait. In those days, there were no real roads up there, where the terrain was extremely rough. And we moved this heavy artillery through the most difficult terrain in the world. So that was, it didn't make sense that this had anything to do with the forward policy. It was launched less than a year before the attacks took place in 1962. And then, of course, we have the aftermath of the actual war. And then, of course, John Delves' The Himalayan Blunder is a very telling book, because he arrived at his POW camp on the Chinese side of the border, where they ordered erected tents to house more than 1,000 POWs, and that interpreters speaking a multitude of Indian languages prepared to take care of all these POWs. This was not a spur-of-the-moment thing. It was nothing that was provoked by the Indians moving one outpost a couple of hundred meters beyond what the Chinese considered, you know, was the line of control. It just didn't make sense. So I started looking at it in a broader perspective. And if you look at what was happening in China and the region at that time, first of all, in the 1950s, India, not China, was the leading voice for the newly independent countries in Africa and in Asia. You have the Bandung Conference and the Panchasila argument. What language is that? It's certainly not Chinese.
Yeah.
It was actually India that brought you and lied to Bandung. And China, of course, had a different worldview. China saw itself as not as a leader of the newly independent countries, but as a center for world revolution.
Mm.
It was necessary to dethrone India from the position of being the leading voice in the third world, which was the Chinese concept, the third world. And they did succeed in doing that in 1962. India's regional prestige was hurt and diminished considerably. There was one reason. Another reason was the flight of the Dalai Lama in 1959. So the old friendship which Nehru had cultivated between India and China, there was history.
Hmm.
And another reason was, of course, what was happening in China at that time. Mao Zedong had launched the Great Leap Forward, which turned out to be a total disaster. It's only in recent years we actually know the extent of that disaster.
Mm.
The 20, 30, maybe 40 million people died from starvation.
Mm.
Mao Zedong's position was really weak. And he was almost on his way out as, you know, leader of the Communist Party. What is then better if you want to put the country together again, consolidate your power, than to find an outside enemy? And then you can unite the country and the military and the people behind you against that outside enemy. And India, of course, was a perfect choice for Mao, as because of the Dalai Lama, because of the unsettled border and a number of other issues, Nehru being the one he was and so on. So I put this all together and I came to the conclusion that China began to prepare for this war in 59. And even then, there was a meeting, which only now the minutes have become clear for, both Deng Xiaoping and Mao Zedong, both of them, said that we will have to teach India a lesson when the time is ripe. And preparations began as early as in 59. That's absolutely correct. So Maxwell's theory doesn't hold water at all.
Sir, in the book you have given an anecdote regarding the reception the book got in China and Pakistan and later Kissinger's reaction to the book. Yeah. Can you talk more about it? How was this book taken and how this book changed the perception about Western scholars looking at India and China?
You mean Neville Maxwell's book?
Neville Maxwell's book.
I mean, the book was perceived, of course, the Chinese loved it because they could see, it was India's fault, not ours. But of course, in Chinese knew that this wasn't actually what happened. They're not stupid. They knew exactly what they had done and why they had done it as well. But it was something that projected China as a victim rather than as an aggressor. And naturally, there was something the Chinese liked to project internationally. And Kissinger referred to this book as, I think I can do business with these people, you know, the Chinese, because they seem to be very reasonable guys. And look, see, they didn't really attack India. They were provoked into a situation like that. Whether Kissinger really believed this or not is very hard to say. Frankly speaking, I don't think he did. Mm. But it was a convenient argument to raise when he wanted to normalize relations with China, that he could say, look, I read Neville Maxwell's book, and, you know, I think he's got a point there. And the Chinese will, of course, love that. So it was more a question of diplomacy and then, you know, historical research and accuracy behind Kissinger's statements at the time.
So it was a book that provided the right substance at the right time for Kissinger to start thinking about, you know, if I was looking at it in a broader context and I want to open up China and sort of create this rift between, and which was anyway developing between the Chinese and the Soviets, and leverage that more, this is a good opportunity to make this argument and say, look, it's not like the Chinese did anything wrong in this sense.
Absolutely. And I should also mention the role of the Soviet Union there, that the relations between India and the Soviet Union were very close in those days.
Yeah.
At the same time as China and the Soviet Union were drifting apart. Mm. So naturally, the Americans would have taken advantage of that, the divide between China and the Soviet Union, and to cultivate relations with China. Mm. Then, of course, it would be very good then to condemn not only the Soviet Union, but also India.
Yeah.
So it fitted into Kissinger's new plan to get America to dominate the world, with China as an ally, strangely enough.
Sir, so over the years, this argument had been established that China was the aggressor. So how, when your book came out, how was the reaction to your book? Because you are making a completely different set of arguments.
Yeah.
So what, did you face any backlash, or how did the narrative change around your book?
Well, I think, first of all, Neville Maxwell went ballistic, predictably so.
Yes.
And he wrote a very strange review of it for Outlook magazine here. And I think he wrote that review before he even read the book, because it wasn't available when he posted this thing.
Your book.
Yes, my book.
Mm-hmm.
And I was invited by Arthur to respond to him. And I said, look, I'm not interested in to get any mudslinging match with Neville Maxwell. My book is there for anyone to read it. If people disagree with Neville Maxwell, yes, I do. I explained that in my book. Leave it to the readers.
Yeah.
Let them respond. I'm not going to respond. Mm. So that was the reaction. But interestingly, this book has been translated into Chinese.
Okay.
But in Taiwan.
Okay.
Oh.
Yes. And the Taiwanese love it.
I'm sure Indians do love it as well.
And I saw it actually on display in the most prestigious bookstore in Taipei when I was there, prominently displayed.
Hmm.
So, and that's because it puts mainland China in the kind of light that the Taiwanese prefer and like. So, and I think the reaction has been, I've not received any serious criticism from anyone, really.
Yeah.
Some scholars have said that I should have looked more into that issue and that issue.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, I can't look into everything.
Exactly. A book has to frame itself within a certain framework, right?
Yes. And more importantly, the book doesn't stop with the 1962 war.
Yeah.
I go on to cover the whole India-China frontier, you know, Nepal, Sikkim, Bhutan.
Yeah.
And how that fits into, you know, the broader geopolitical perspective.
Yeah.
So it's also a book about the present as much as a book about the past.
All right. So that's what we'll get to now. We'll get to the present. And in the present context, I mean, 1962 sort of created this fissure between India and China. And since subsequently sort of heydays of the early 50s, where you could have had some sort of bonhomie and some sort of working together, that sense of partnership vanished, and then you had a sense of competition and conflict. And then by sort of the late 80s, 90s, again, there's this new sense of partnership. And then we come to today, where again, that early bit of partnership from the 90s to the 2000s, I mean, there's that ugly phrase that I keep referring to in the office every time we talk about India-China, the idea of Chindia, both countries rising together. And that's gone again. Yeah. We are again sort of in this mode of competition.
Sure.
And sometimes intensified competition, not just on the borders, but also, say, in third countries like Bhutan, where the Doklam incident happened. But broadly also the Indian Ocean region now. And that's where much of the focus is, given the U.S. now has an Indo-Pacific strategy. Everybody has some sort of an Indo-Pacific strategy without really knowing what those strategies are. And the Chinese are sort of also more vigorously competing with Belt and Road. Firstly, I wanted to get your sense on Belt and Road. What exactly is Belt and Road according to you? Because it's a confused concept, right?
It's a very good question. Does anyone know what the Belt and Road actually is? There's everything from a coloring book for children, the Belt and Road coloring book, to amusement parks in Italy and Australia. And then, of course, all these other projects which have to do with infrastructure and so on. The peculiar thing about Belt and Road is that China doesn't have any ministry and a governmental agency that actually coordinates Belt and Road initiatives. It's a kind of broad-based concept of China reaching out to the rest of the world and with the ultimate aim of becoming the leading power, superpower, on the global superpower, to overtake the role that's been played by the United States for several decades. Whether it's going to succeed or not, it's very hard to say, because first of all, I think China is overstretching itself. They cannot they don't have the resources to do everything they have claimed that they're going to do and build. And secondly, there's too much opposition already. Only a few years after Xi Jinping launched his Belt and Road Initiative, there's unhappiness in a country like Myanmar, which I cover and I've covered for many years. They don't really want the Chinese to come in there and build railways and roads and ports and that sort of thing, and then give loans to the government, which had to be repaid. They be caught in what we call a debt trap, like Sri Lanka has done with the port project and so on. We have Gwadar in Pakistan, but it's moving in the same direction. A big highway to nowhere coming down from the Karakoram Heights to the coast and so on. China is encountering all these problems in opposition to its plans. And then in the midst of all this comes the coronavirus, the COVID-19. And suddenly, the Belt and Road Initiative has been definitely put on ice.
Yeah.
We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know how long this pandemic, or whatever you want to call it, is going to last. But certainly, no one is going to deal with China for a considerable length of time after this.
Yeah.
And certainly, no one would like to welcome thousands of Chinese workers to come to the countries after this. Dissent and dissatisfaction in the countries where there's nothing that really benefits local people. They don't employ local people. They say, oh, it's a language thing. We have to have our own people. So they bring in their own workers. It causes even more frictions with the populations, the local populations in the countries where they are active. So the Chinese haven't handled this Belt and Road Initiative particularly cleverly. They have handled it in a very arrogant way. It's just creating more enemies than friends, I would argue.
Yet they've got sort of many countries that are working with them, and in Myanmar itself, right? And they've planted themselves in a far wider area than they were previously. And in the Indian Ocean region, so we've seen in the last couple of years, the Maldives, Sri Lanka, I mentioned Burma. There's been also work in Nepal, which has caused friction with India over a period of time for many reasons, apart from just the Chinese presence. I mean, India's also made mistakes in Nepal. But the fact is that they are far more engaged in this region. And therefore, as Ambassador Shivshankar Menon keeps saying, right, our peripheries are expanding and our interests are expanding. So we're going to rub against each other much more. And that's going to create much more friction. If you're looking at this sort of as a new great game that's being played out, what are the sort of dynamics of this great game? I mean, do the Chinese, while they might not achieve every objective of whatever Belt and Road can be ascribed as, defined as, has already achieved the objective of China's presence expanding, China's strategic scope, a sort of interest and strategic leverage expanding in the region, whether it be with ports in Myanmar or whether it be in sort of potential bases in and around Maldives, which they were trying to do with Yamin, or with, say, in Sri Lanka, their sort of interest? And how does that impact sort of India's security?
Well, first of all, I don't think ports are the most important part of this. But if you look at the importance of the Indian Ocean and the Indian Ocean region for China, most of China's trade goes through the Indian Ocean. Most of their fossil fuel imports comes from the Middle East, some from Central Asia, the former Soviet republics there, but more importantly from the Middle East. The imports of minerals from Africa go through the Indian Ocean. Exports to the Middle East, to Africa, to Europe, through the Indian Ocean. Australia, to the Indian Ocean, and also minerals from Australia. So the Indian Ocean is of utmost importance to China when it comes to economic development. And people say, well, it has nothing to do with the military power and so on. But wait a minute. If your economy is that dependent on all these trade routes, you need a defense umbrella to protect those trade routes. It would be stupid to do otherwise. So naturally, China is moving into the Indian Ocean, or the Chinese military is moving into the Indian Ocean as well. They just, a couple of years ago, established the first military base abroad in Djibouti, in the Horn of Africa. the entrance to the Red Sea and the Suez Canal, hardly by coincidence. And more important than investment in ports, which are commercial ports, they can have a dual purpose, but mainly they're commercial ports. What is more important is actually the Chinese naval presence in the Indian Ocean. Mm. And China now, for the first time in history, is building a blue water navy. Mm. They had Shanghai in the 15th century, crisscrossing the Indian Ocean to Africa and so on. But after that, for hundreds of years, the Chinese never went beyond their own shorelines, really, unless they wanted to emigrate to America or Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
But it was done on foreign ships anyway.
Yeah.
The Chinese Republic had no navy. They had a river navy, river boats and so on, to suppress banditry in the hinterland. But now, for the first time, they're building a navy. They got the first aircraft carriers. They build one, they're getting another one. And they have submarines. And China's submarine presence in the Indian Ocean has been increasing over the past decades and so on. And that is actually the way they're going to defend and protect their trade routes. Mm. You have also, there was a lot of talk about China's intelligence, signals intelligence bases in Burma some years ago, in the Cocoa Islands and so on. Well, I always argue that those are not Chinese bases. They are Burmese bases being upgraded with Chinese assistance. Mm. Yes, they are important, but China doesn't actually need those antennas anyway.
Yeah.
They go to spy ships. Mm. The big ships smack full of electronic gadgets which crisscross not only the Indian Ocean, but also the Pacific Ocean. Mm. And they're not dependent on any ports, really. They do go into ports once in a while to refuel or whatever, but they can stay for a considerable length of time at sea. Mm. And that is why they collect signals intelligence. But nevertheless, the bottom line here is that we cannot say that it's just trade routes, just commercial, because we're talking about vital imports and exports, where China feels it needs to have a defense umbrella to protect those trade routes. And that is, with that comes the military presence as well. And that is when China's interests are going to collide with India's, and not only India's, but also America's. America's, one of the most important military bases, is in the Guernsey, the British Indian Ocean Territory. And then you have Australia on the Cocos Keeling Islands, where they've got an old base. You have France in La Réunion, and India, of course, in the Andaman Islands and elsewhere. So naturally, you have a lot of interests which collide in the Indian Ocean. And that makes the Indian Ocean read much more volatile, I would argue, than even the South China Sea. The positions are kind of locked. Mm. You got spy satellites monitoring every little movement down there.
Yeah.
And the Indian Ocean is much more unpredictable. Mm. And another element in the Indian Ocean that makes it more unpredictable is the fact that there are a number of very small, vulnerable island nations there, like the Maldives, the Comoros, the Seychelles, Mauritius to some extent, which the Chinese are now penetrating, gaining influence.
So two questions on what you have said already. One, so do you concede that, I agree with the strategic part, the great geopolitical game that way is playing out and that will be played out in future. But do you concede in the past that it started as a way to address Chinese overcapacity, and the smaller island nations or the smaller countries are definitely benefiting from BRI, as in they are getting some infrastructure due to BRI. One, do you agree with that part? And second, how can you emphasize more on how this is playing out? How is Chinese investment in smaller island countries helping them to gain their influence more?
Mm. Well, when China invests in small island nations, they usually invest in symbols of power, like a new police station, a big bridge, a sports stadium, parliament, building parliament building and so on. That has been the strategy in the Pacific Ocean for years, really. And you cannot even see the same kind of thing in the smaller island nations in the Indian Ocean. This new bridge between the airport and Mali, for instance, the Friendship Bridge in the Maldives. And they've got similar things going on in the Comoros. In Seychelles, they tried to build something, but when I was there, actually, the truck drivers there went on strike, because they didn't want any Chinese truck drivers to come there and compete with them. So it's not always that easy for the Chinese to make these kind of inroads. But you're right, of course they are gaining influence. But one also has to remember that Chinese assistance comes at a price. It usually loans, credits, which one day have to be repaid. And if they can't repay them, they can be a debt for equity kind of situation, where they then take over, for instance, the ports in Sri Lanka or some other installations which they're paid for, which the host country cannot afford to repay in terms of loans. So it's a strategy that's designed to extend China's influence in the region and to gain influence through using aid, so-called aid, as a weapon, really, to gain that kind of influence. I'm not saying that this is completely useless. I mean, in the Comoros, for instance, they build a lot of health clinics, hospitals, and so on, And of course, that's great. But it's part of trying to win the hearts and minds of the local populations as well, which is so equally important. They can't just come in and build a bridge and then leave, you know. They want to get some kind of sympathy from the local population, a better understanding. And they go to Confucius Institutes everywhere now where people get free Chinese language lessons. Apparently quite popular in Kathmandu, I understand. And it's free, and you even get support if you want to go there and study. Mm. So, you know, Chinese foreign policy comes on many different levels. Mm. And it's not all evil. I'm not saying that at all. But I have to look at it in the broader perspective, that this is designed and meant to turn China into the leading economic and political, perhaps even military power in the world.
Just to add to that, so one of the sort of aspects of influence is a sort of value-based system which legitimizes your structures, your norms, and things like that. And in the conversation that we had just before we started recording this podcast, you were talking about China sort of exporting a system. It might not be exactly the same Communist Party system, but a form of governance. And this is a point of friction also in the context of India, right? So just this week, we had the former Indian Foreign Secretary Vijay Gokhale giving a speech in which he said that, look, India's democracy and the prospect of a large democracy prospering economically and so on and so forth is a challenging prospect from a Chinese perspective also. Mm-hmm. So could you talk to us a little bit about that aspect from an India-China point of view, but also in terms of how China is potentially undermining democracy within the broader East Asian and Indian Ocean region?
Well, I'm a journalist, but contrary to what people may think, we journalists are also human beings. And we do have our own opinions and ideas and so on. And if I may express my own view on this matter, honestly, I can say that I prefer the chaotic Indian democracy any day to China's authoritarian, dictatorial rule. This chaos is wonderful compared to what you see in China and experience when you are there. So that's my personal opinion.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that this opinion is shared by everyone in Asia. It's not. And China is doing its utmost to sell this idea that in order to get economic influence, you cannot afford to have democracy. A lot of political parties or politicians and so on. You have to have a strong ruler, a strong center, authoritarian government. And that kind of policy projection is, some people believe it, and some people are buying it. And in Thailand, where I live, yes, certainly, some people are talking about that. Maybe these politicians are just a bunch of corrupt guys. We don't really need them. Wasn't it better if we had an authoritarian ruler? But as soon as an authoritarian ruler takes over, people rise up and say, wait a minute, not having the freedom of speech anymore? What is this all about? And then they have demonstrations and riots and all this sort of thing. So it's a kind of, people talk about a benevolent dictatorship, but that's a contradiction in terms. A dictatorship cannot be never benevolent by nature.
Yes.
With democracy comes chaos, yes, sure. There's a price you have to pay. But if that is have an impact on economic development, I mean, there are many other countries which have prospered under democracy. Look at South Korea, and most importantly, Taiwan, which is probably the most dynamic democracy in Asia right now. And not being recognized by anyone because China considers it a renegade province. But go to China and to Taiwan and try to sell the Chinese model there, and people will probably throw you out, you know.
Yes.
Taiwan has really shown the way for how democracy can work. And it does work very well. I mean, it's far more vibrant, I would say, than Japan is a democracy too, but it's kind of very heavy and stagnant, really. South Korea is somewhere in between, but Taiwan, I mean, it's a fantastic example of how democracy and economic development can go hand in hand.
Yeah.
Of course, you can say it's a small country, but it's not that small, really, and it doesn't really matter. It works.
It
works very well.
Yeah, the system works, and it can therefore work in other places also.
Absolutely.
And I think even sort of from an Indian point of view, it's obviously shown that, I mean, the development that we've had from 1990s particularly, where we've lifted millions out of, hundreds of millions, a couple of hundred million people at least out of poverty, it shows that even in a democracy you can deliver. And that's, in terms of if you're just looking at that as a developmental metric, that's, again, historically second to only what the Chinese have achieved in the last 40 years, which tells you that the system actually can deliver, despite its chaos.
Sure.
So I had one sort of last question which I wanted to ask, which was in the context of Myanmar specifically.
Yeah.
The Chinese are heavily engaged over there. They're also engaged in conflict management in some ways, and stoking the conflict in some ways. Could you tell us a little bit about that engagement, and how does the sort of relationship between what could be potentially a state that the Chinese nurture as a potential client state, although not necessarily a client state, And what are the sort of different frictions? And because it's an ethnically diverse state, and therefore it requires much more better management. And the Chinese are far more used to dealing with, so they deal with ethnic diversity with the hammer. So how do they manage that sort of relationship with a state like that?
First of all, I have to understand and recognize the strategic importance of Burma and Myanmar to China. Because Burma is the only country, neighboring country, which shares a common border with China. They provide China with a safe outlet to the Indian Ocean. Of course, there's India, but I don't think anything's going to happen there.
Yeah.
You got Pakistan, the Karakoram Highway, I mean, it goes up to 5,000 meters or whatever above sea level, blocked by ice and snow in winter, and the most dangerous highway in the world. You get down to the lowlands in Pakistan, you have all this unpredictable political turmoil. Of course, you have a civil war going in Burma, but China can handle that. And one thing here to understand when looking at Chinese foreign policy is that China doesn't want peace. China wants stability. Stability that they can use to their strategic advantage. It is in China's interest to keep the ethnic wars in Burma going, for the time being at least. Because they give them leverage, they give them influence. They can play the peace broker, the peacemaker. They can tell the government in Naypyidaw that, look, we are the only country that can help you solve this problem. Forget about all these peaceniks coming from Switzerland and Norway or whatever. They don't even understand what's happening here anyway. So that is the reason why China is having good relations with the government and the military in Myanmar at the same time as they're arming the United World State Army, the most important non-governmental army in the country. Yeah? So one has to look at Chinese policy in a different light from the foreign policies of other countries. It's not the same. And China also has this thing about differentiating between government-to-government and party-to-party relations, which is, of course, totally artificial in a country where there's only one party that forms the government. But it gives China a kind of flexibility that other countries don't have. They can claim that support for the WA, not the WA State Army in Burma. No, that's party-to-party. It's got nothing to do with the government. And there's a remarkable kind of policy, but people don't seem to be reacting too much against it or think it's that strange, really. Yeah. But the bottom line is that China needs Burma to get outlet to the Indian Ocean, to bypass the South China Sea, they contest the South China Sea, and the Straits. The Malacca Strait, the congested waters of the Malacca Strait. And therefore, they want influence there. In the beginning, they put all the eggs in one basket, the military. That backfired badly. So now they diversify the contacts. They have contacts with everybody, and especially with the government under Aung San Suu Kyi, who was seen as really dangerous kind of person by the Chinese saw it that way in the past. He was married to a Tibet scholar, and she was talking about, leader of a pro-democracy movement. But now they've become very good friends, and she goes to China all the time to get help because she's a politician. She wants to be reelected. The West has turned their backs on her because of her stance in the Rohingya issue, the refugee crisis on the on the border with Bangladesh. So China is happily moving in to give her everything she needs. On the other hand, the Myanmar military, the Tamado, as we call them, whatever we may think about them, they see themselves as protectors, the protectors of the sovereignty of the nation, the independence, and that sort of thing. They are much more suspicious of China than the government is, the elected popular government. But it's complete reverse roles from in the past. And when they were had a good relationship with the military and not with the Aung San Suu Kyi, now Aung San Suu Kyi has become the favorite, whereas the military is grumping in the background. And I know this for talking to Myanmar army officers, that they think, now that lady is just going too far. We cannot let her, sell our country to the Chinese. So roles are completely reversed now. Yeah. But again, the Chinese can play these games, and they're playing them very cleverly. But then, of course, you have public opinion, the public perceptions of China in Burma. They are really very, very negative. And there is a danger there, because Burma has quite a substantial ethnic Chinese population. They've been there for decades, for generations. They're basically Burmese, but they're Chinese descent. They speak Burmese, they're Burmese names. They maybe speak Chinese at home. And most of them are into business, businessmen in major cities, Rangoon, Mandalay, and so on. And there's a fear among them, I know that for a fact from talking to them, that they are afraid that they will be victimized if the newly arrived Chinese misbehave. They'll continue to misbehave, I would say, because they're already doing that. And that could easily happen, because in 1967, there were riots in Rangoon's Chinatown. Many Chinese homes were ransacked, and many Chinese were killed. And they could easily happen again. And then the question is, if it happens again, what will China do? Will China intervene to protect the lives of their citizens and their compatriots? Quite possible. America does it all the time, don't they?
Yes.
So why can't China do that?
Yeah.
then we will see a military intervention or some kind of security intervention in Burma, which will be something completely new.
Yeah.
But whatever it is, China wants to maintain its hold of Burma by playing many different cards at the same time, because it's the only country that provides them with safe and easy access to the Indian Ocean.
All right, Sesh. Sir, so in that context, what is India doing? Is India doing enough to negate that influence? Is India itself is playing a card to increase its influence in Myanmar? How is this playing out against India?
Well, I can only say that I'm surprised that India is not doing more, because it would be in India's interest to cultivate better relations with Myanmar. They've been sort of neglected, because as I usually tell people, I think India is sort of obsessed with the Western border. Yes, I can understand. Two nuclear power nations, conflicts over Kashmir and all that. But there's no dynamics there. Nothing is really going to change. But if you look at the eastern border, then there are opportunities and there are challenges that India could take advantage of. Trade, security issues, cross-border insurgencies, you know, rebels from Nagaland and Manipur and Assam having bases on the other side of the border. Trade with Southeast Asia, where Myanmar is right in between India and Southeast Asia. So I'm surprised that India is not paying more attention to it. They got this look east policy, which became act east. But honestly, I don't see that much action.
Yeah, all right. So with the hope that there will be some more action, and with the hope that there would be a better rationalization of our interest in that region, and the Indian government will actually act more in the east. I'd like to say thank you so much. Thank you so much for all the insights, and thank you so much for talking to us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle, @TakshashilaInst, or our website, takshashila.org.in.